Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Arsenal Way podcast in association with Football.London's coverage of the Gunners across the 2022-23 season. This is our pilot episode of what is hopefully going to be a weekly podcast where myself, Tom Canton, or one of our other hosts will be joined weekly by Arsenal writer Kaya Karnak. How you doing, mate? You good, Joel?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to seeing what we're able to come up with and hopefully getting everyone who's listening involved as much as possible, seeing where we go with this kind of thing. And yeah, it should be a fun year as we're going through the season. Should be good.
Absolutely. I mean, it started off as fun as it could possibly be, to be fair. Three wins to kick off the season. And of course, hopefully another one at the weekend. With this being the first episode and starting, of course, three games into the season, it does make sense if we kick things off by going and looking back at how the season has started. And I suppose the best place to start is, how surprised are you that we've won three games, considering they're against Crystal Palace and Leicester and, of course, most recently Bournemouth? I mean, there's a couple of banana skins, I think, in there that we've been able to avoid, but yeah. I still think they're three games that most people would have expected us to pick up 3 points in.
Yeah, but having said that, we got no points from Palace last year. We got six from Leicester. I don't know what the equivalent team to Bournemouth is from last season, but you know, yeah, those aren't necessarily points that were on the board. But I'm going to go back to the word we used at the start of this podcast. I'm going to say fun is how I describe those first three games. And like, obviously you went into it expecting Arsenal to win and they were the favourites, and you know, no one's getting too carried away with themselves, despite what I think a lot of people are saying on social media, and people sort of celebration police are out again and being all critical of the club for getting carried away about the fact they're top of the league. I don't think anyone's realistically saying that Arsenal are in a title charge or anything like that because of the fact that they've won three games. It's just like, it's as good a season start as it could have been. And I'm not surprised because the summer and pre-season went so well. Like, they've got all the transfers they wanted done. Everything, we'll talk a bit more about transfers later in the show, but everything else is kind of a bonus at this point. So yeah, they've planned it really well. And like, I don't know what you think, but I think sort of the idea of playing the same starting 11 twice in a row in the pre-season games going into it has been really clever, because everyone's talking about, you know, Arsenal played unchanged three games in a row. Realistically, it's five.
And yeah,
that is massive, I think.
Yeah, I think especially because pre-season was kind of looked upon in kind of a critical fashion, actually, because we didn't take many youngsters at all, you know, on that trip. And that was one of the big things and disappointments, that we weren't seeing Patino, we weren't seeing Salah, we weren't seeing Brooke Norton Cuffey and potentially the likes of Kayon Edwards to a lesser extent. But actually, what it's been able to do for us is not only demonstrate how much strength and depth that we've got in the team still, with plenty of players that, of course, now moved on, Pablo Marie, of course, being a key example of that, as well as others, but that we were able to, as you say, use those starting fixtures against Sevilla and Chelsea, weren't they, that we used the same lineup into those games. And that consistency has been absolutely beneficial to the start of our season. You compare that, not only the results, but the teams, the last season. You know, Aubameyang and Lacazette were out with COVID. Ben White, of course, got, you know, I think he was unwell as well, you know, after the second game of the season. So all of those things combined led to a very frantic, chaotic and more challenging in terms of the fixtures that we faced start the 2021-22 season. But this season's been a lot more organised, a lot more consistent. And that, I think, has obviously bled onto the field. But it's still been a step up in performance, most importantly. And I think our new signings have had a big thing to do with that, haven't they?
Yeah, speaking of things that are fun, let's remind ourselves of Brentford last year. But no, that was so much fun. But yeah, the signings have been big. And watching this All or Nothing documentary, the big takeaway for me has been how motivated those guys seemed at the end of it to come back and go again. And yeah, I think, and listen, this is a comparison that doesn't quite stack up because Liverpool were going for the title. But that season where Liverpool got, was it 97 points and they still came second?
Yeah.
They could easily have fallen away and like lost faith and been really disappointed. But what they did was they came back, they went again, and they won the title by quite some distance. And there was sort of the motivating factor, I think, behind that was how close they'd come the season before. A lot of the reason why successful teams tend to be as successful as they are is because they've sort of got that motivation of not wanting to lose again behind them. And absolutely, the All or Nothing documentary has been big, hasn't it? Because everyone's just been sort of noticing that this team really was quite hurt by the fact that they couldn't come top four. I mean, they were so close, but yet so far at the end. And now I think we're seeing the motivation. They started like a house on fire, and obviously tougher tests are to come. And Fulham this weekend probably isn't one of those, and Villa the next game probably isn't one of those either. But it's the kind of games that, and the kind of starts of the season that you need to build momentum. And there's lots of factors as to why getting points on the board is good. You know, the World Cup, obviously being in the middle of the season, is big. That kind of stuff always helps. So yeah, it's positive and yeah, fun. I mean, I enjoy going to Arsenal games again, whereas, you know, as much as I'm in a privileged position to go, a lot of those lockdown games, I wasn't really looking forward to going to them because I was thinking, you know, how are Arsenal going to score? How am I going to watch this team try for 90 minutes to pass the ball around the goal and nowhere near it? Whereas now it's so much more fun to watch them because you know what you're going to see. You know you're going to see fun attacking play. And I think it's a really good time to be an Arsenal fan, and probably a good time to be starting a podcast all about Arsenal, isn't it?
Yeah, potentially. And I mean, it's what it isn't a good time for is to person trying to get tickets, because that's proving to be incredibly difficult for fans. You know, so many of friends of mine that have tried to get tickets have unfortunately missed out. If you are listening and are a season ticket holder and for whatever reason can't go to a game, please put your ticket on Ticket Exchange, because it really does help out more fans. And of course, it does fill the stadium if you aren't able to go. So really important to kind of push that ahead. But it was interesting. You talked there about like Liverpool and kind of the differences in what we've seen from them and how they're able to kind of build upon their seasons. But looking back kind of the history of their rise, they had a season where they finished on 76 points and we obviously finished fifth. And that was in 2016-17. In 2017-18. Yeah. Of course. I mean, and then 75 points the year later in 2017-18 when Arsenal were dropping down to sixth as well, unfortunately. But then in 2018-19, they went from that 75-ish point mark all the way up to 97 in the space of one season. And I think that was obviously the year that they brought in the likes of Alisson and Van Dijk, and obviously we know the differences that they made. But whilst I don't want to compare Saliba with Van Dijk and Alisson with the influence of Zinchenko, or, you know, what they've managed to have up top with Salah and Mane and Firmino with the introduction of Jesus for us, but you can see a significant step up in the level of quality across the Arsenal team with just a few additions to the side, just three starting players that have changed this year. We finished, I think, was it 69 points last season? What do you think is a realistic expectation with those additions that we could step up from a points totals perspective?
Tough to say. I mean, we're going to win every single game, aren't we? So 114.
We have so far.
Yeah, that's the challenge we're setting ourselves. But I don't know. Going back to that Liverpool comparison, the interesting thing for me is it was so obvious what Liverpool needed. Obviously, they had that Champions League final against Real Madrid where Lloris Karius threw the ball into Karim Benzema, and that was clear. They needed a better goalkeeper. And it was clear they needed better defenders than Dejan Lovren and Joel Matip at the back. I think it was Klavan was playing for them as well at the time.
Yeah.
So we've had a similar renaissance in the sense that we clearly needed a better striker, because as much as we all love Lacazette for how much he tried and ran himself into the ground every game and celebrated with passion and was a leader around the training ground, generally quite a good guy, although, you know, that final episode of All or Nothing suggests he lost his temper just as much as others. But I think it was clear that Arsenal needed a striker, and it was clear that they needed a left-back to compete with Kieran Tierney as well in the squad. Beyond that, I think you were questioning sort of how totally necessary everything was, and William Saliba coming into the back line has obviously improved things in the sense that the right-back options are now suddenly so much stronger as well. And yeah, I think in terms of squad depth, you know, right now we're in a privileged position at Arsenal in the sense that they don't really have any injuries to contend with, not to serious first team players anyway. And I think that makes a big difference. And we have to bear in mind that those injuries will come. If someone like, I don't know, if Gabriel Jesus, for example, were tomorrow to get injured, then Arsenal would be in a less strong position to go and win those games that, you know, we're predicting them to win every single one this season. But in terms of points, tough. I think it was 69 last year. I don't think it's unreasonable to expect maybe a 6-point jump, which is, you know, given how many games Arsenal lost last season when they probably shouldn't have lost. If you think back to that Old Trafford game, the Everton game.
Yeah.
The three, Brentford. Yeah. Well, that game, in my opinion, shouldn't have gone ahead because of all the COVID cases.
Of course,
if that game had happened, if it hadn't been the first game of the season, then I think probably wouldn't have gone ahead, to be honest. But that's
you think, you think of that stretch of three games where we lost to Palace, Brighton and Southampton, you know, those three.
For sure.
That Southampton game in particular, like, we dominated the game. It was different to the Brighton and Palace games because, you know, any other week I'd bet on Arsenal winning with that performance, not changing anything, just the clinical finish that Saka could have had in the first half. There was a chance, I think, in the second half as well that we missed. And then they had an opportunity just dropped in from the box to...
Yeah, it's better. And it wasn't like with those Palace and Brighton games where, you know, Palace were clearly the better team. Brighton did a number on Arsenal in terms of the game plan. Southampton got one chance and scored from it. Arsenal didn't score any of their chances, and that was kind of it, really. And that was top four. I mean, how many points did Arsenal finish off? 2 points. So if they managed to find a way to win that game, then they would have been top four. Simple as that. And there will be those kind of games throughout the season. This is a young squad who are inconsistent, and I think we've got to be ready for that. But the strength of positivity around the squad right now, I think, means they're better prepared for it than they would have been. And those experiences last year mean they sort of know how to handle it and how to get through those difficult situations. So I'd say 6-point jump is, you know, not too unrealistic. And what is it, 75 points last season, if I'm not mistaken, would have got you third? I'm not 100% certain.
I can quickly check on that. But yeah, 75 points would have got you third, yes.
Yes, fantastic. See, that is top quality audio. Man looks up on the internet for listeners to listen to. But yeah, sorry about that, guys. I'm still getting used to this new format. But yeah, so if Arsenal go up by 6 points, I don't think anyone will be too shocked, given how they've started the season. And I think, you know, they look like they could do it. And Mikel Arteta's not happy with the way the team are playing right now. Like, he's not fully happy. He's still targeting improvements. I think we all can see, you know, there's areas that could improve. And this is a team winning 3 and 4 every week. So very, very upbeat and positive right now.
You used the word prepared. We're obviously still in the crux of a transfer window in which, you know, I think a lot of us Arsenal fans can see, and I think even beyond Arsenal as well, that people can see that Arsenal are light in midfield, they're light potentially up top. Are Arsenal prepared? Because, you know, we use that word with what we've done, but is there an element of us, if Partey gets injured, or if Xhaka gets injured, or if Jesus gets injured, or if Saka gets injured, are we underprepared for the season?
Yeah. The thing is about Thomas Partey, he's a player who is very difficult to replace. And I think, as maybe Arsenal fans and Arsenal writers and media in general, we get quite fixated on, so if one player comes out, they have to have someone come in and play the exact same role. And that's not always necessarily the case. So Eddie Nketiah and Gabriel Jesus are similar strikers, but they're not the same. So if Arsenal were to lose Gabriel Jesus, you know, fingers crossed this doesn't happen at all, but if Arsenal were to lose Gabriel Jesus for, let's say, how long was Partey out for towards the end of last season? 6 weeks.
They
come up with alternative solutions that would revolve around maybe giving Eddie a bit more support up front, maybe playing more attacking fullbacks, maybe getting more attacking midfielders in the team. And they've got solutions that mean they don't just have to go like for like right now. So, for example, if Partey were to be absent, then I think, you know, obviously the obvious replacement is Moel Nenny, who can do a lot of the defensive screening that Partey does. But if you want someone coming in to replace the on-the-ball stuff, then Zinchenko can play at 6. And Sambi Lokonga, in my opinion, is best at as an 8, but, you know, he can play as a 6 too if you really want someone who can replicate the passing capabilities. So I think there are options in a way that there weren't last season. And the squad was so thin last season that it was sort of, if they lose any of the big players, then they're in big trouble because there's no one to come in to replace them. Whereas now, if they lose, you know, an important player, then there are alternatives to change it. And I don't think Mikel Arteta views it as sort of, my team play this way, so therefore I have to have someone to come in. I think he sort of, the phrase I use in my writing a lot is sort of a Swiss Army knife squad.
Yeah.
In the sense that it's one to break down various different oppositions that Arsenal come up against. And I think it makes sense for them to do that. And you can see that with the signings they made. Every single one of them has been versatile. Zinchenko, I mean, I don't really think any of us know what position he plays. Obviously, he's a left back, but God knows where he is on the pitch half the time. And Vieira is very versatile. Jesus can play anywhere along the front line. Who are the other signings? Marquinhos can play anywhere along the front line. Pedro Neto, should he come in, would be able to play anywhere across the front line as well. Yeah. So, yeah, they're going for versatility, and they've got solutions, definitely.
It's just about now whether or not they can obviously get those solutions across the line, because if they don't, you know, there's going to be questions, of course, as there always is questions. I've been very impressed with the business that we've done. You know, I'd probably give us a 7.5 to 8 out of 10 for the window to this stage. The outgoings, of course, have been a part of that. It's been a frustration that we've not been able to get as much money as maybe we'd hoped, especially for players like, you know, Bernd Leno, Lucas Torreira, players that we could have got more money from, but the situations have dictated that to become quite tricky. Hector Bellerin, of course, probably will end up moving on for next to nothing, if anything at all. Do you see Arsenal changing that kind of reputation in terms of sales from, say, next summer, when there's more assets for us to move on from, better pieces of investment earlier on down the line?
That's certainly the aim. If you look at the way Arsenal have done their business recently in terms of investing in younger players and lowering the age profile of the squad, that has been what they've been trying to do. So they've been trying to get out of this cycle of terminating contracts, letting players go on the cheap, having players who clearly have no future and have no value in the transfer market. Players like Hector Bellerin, Mustafi, Sokratis, Ozil, Kolasinac, Guendouzi. Well, maybe not Guendouzi, but I could go on with a list of contract terminations. I'm sure there's people I've forgotten within that list. And they're trying to avoid that now. So if you look at the players they've brought in, obviously we all know about the general 23 and under. Obviously Jesus and Zinchenko were 25, but generally it's been 23 and under in terms of recruitment. And that means that going forward, Arsenal will be able to, if they're in a position where a club comes in, so let's pick, you know, pick an Arsenal player from the squad at random now. I'll put you on the spot.
Ooh, let's go with Odegaard.
Odegaard. Okay. Let's say tomorrow Real Madrid come in and they decide they want Odegaard again. Arsenal now are in a very strong position where they've got him under contract for a very long period of time, another 3 years on his current deal, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So if they want to sell, they hold all the cards and they basically are able to drive a price up in as much as they want. And we've seen this with teams like Liverpool have done it very effectively in the past. Even Man City do it quite well, and that is something that, you know, the club are trying to address. And I think in terms of a long term plan and creating cycles that are more effective for a team like Arsenal, that's what they want to do. So yeah, I think the reset of the squad has helped that. I think there will still be cases. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen with Nicola Pepe. As far as I'm aware, there isn't an option to buy included in the deal yet, but you know, the talks are still ongoing with Nice. But that could be another one where Arsenal are forced to let him go on the cheap. But you know, beyond that, you're looking at the squad and you don't really see too many cases where Arsenal are going to have to do that anymore. And I think, yeah, Edu has said, he said in an interview with Football London that the policy is for that to change in the long run, and they want to create something a bit more sustainable, a bit more self-sustaining. Obviously, we know that Arsenal spent a lot of money and there's a few murmurs of some FFP issues going on right now. Mm. But I think in the long run, it's the idea is for that not to be a problem, for Arsenal to be able to sustain themselves ideally through the occasional player sale. And that's I think a smart policy. I think that's what big teams do. The best well-run, the most well-run teams around Europe are doing that, and it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think that when it comes down to the renewal of contracts, there needs to be obviously like this kind of cycle process. A player's renewed 2-3 seasons after that renewal, you know, we need to be focused on trying to get them renewed. Or if they aren't going to do that, then need to look about how we find a solution that financially benefits the club. So with the Gabriel Magalhaes example, for instance, you know, I think he's got three seasons left. He's on a 5-year deal in 2020, didn't he? So yeah, including this one and then two more after that. So in terms of what happens next summer with him, if he isn't going to renew with 2 years left on his deal and say Juventus come back in for him, you would think, yeah, look, if they offer upwards of £50 million, you can get another left-footed centre-back, you would think, with the finance that we've got, probably around a similar age. Take the money, bring another player in. I mean, it was interesting watching Liverpool, you know, the other night against Manchester United. Their midfield was just quite stale. I mean, their entire team was quite stale because they had I think they had the same team in 2018 bar two players, which was Diaz and Elliot, which were replaced by Mane and Wijnaldum 4 years ago. And, you know, this is a team that hasn't seen too much turnover. And I thought the strategy at Liverpool was sound. And, you know, it's allowed them to kind of elevate themselves to the Champions League level and Premier League title challenging level. But if they're not going to turn over the squad, you know, enough by only bringing in one signing this summer. I think they only brought in one or two last summer. And yes, that you get your squad gets to a stage where you don't want to move players on, but you also need to keep the hunger alive in a team. And I feel like if Arsenal are going to push towards title challenges one day, which we all hope that that is the aim, and we assume that that is, of course, the aim, then this team that we're seeing winning the first three games of the season probably can't be the starting lineup in three seasons' time. You need to have that turnover.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I think, in fairness to Liverpool, what they have done, which is what Arsenal want to do, is they've brought in replacements well in advance, generally before letting players go. So I know we spoke about they've not... The team against Man U was relatively similar to the team that has appeared 4 years before. I think that was unfortunate in the sense they've had a lot of injuries.
Of course.
And that kind of influences that. But with Arsenal, they're trying to do a similar thing where what Liverpool have done with Diaz, in the sense they probably knew Sadio Mane was on his way out of the club, and they went out before and got a replacement for him to put themselves in a smart position so that they can say, look, you know, we've got a guy, we don't want to let him go, but we've got someone in ready to replace him. And I think that's what the Albert Sambi Lokonga deal, for example, is about. So if Thomas Partey gets bought by a bigger club, then Arsenal will say, well, yeah, we've got Albert Sambi Lokonga, who we feel, you know, as much as externally we're all a bit unsure over his position, internally they do feel that he, in the long run, can play number six and do that role. And similar vibes going on across the club. They'll be sort of looking towards the academy, they'll be looking towards external buyers, buying smart. And I'd be surprised, you know, let's say the Gabriel example you mentioned there, if he were to leave next summer, I'd be surprised if they let him go without bringing in a left-footed centre-back first. So that's sort of, that's a long-term strategy, and they'll have a replacement in place. And Edu has said that he admires Liverpool's strategy when it comes to that kind of thing. So I think that's what they're going to try and do when it comes to rebuilding the squad. And obviously, the overhaul has been massive in the past couple of seasons because stylistically, there need to be a lot of changes for Mikel Arteta's style of play. But in terms of short-term stuff, I just think it makes sense you know, get the replacements in and then sell afterwards, and it puts Arsenal in a very strong position.
Absolutely. And I think that ultimately the position that Arsenal found themselves in when Arteta took over was much to do with a lack of, you know, really sound planning and strategy in the recruitment and in the market. And that has been addressed very quickly. It's taken time. It's seen us suffer with, you know, back-to-back eighth place finishes at times. Yeah. But you can see from the evidence of last season and the business that's been done this summer and the last summer and the way we started this season, how there is such a clear style of play of what Arteta's trying to build at the club as well. All of these factors combined obviously should give most, if not all, Arsenal supporters that confidence that the direction that we want to see the club go in is the track that we are now on, as opposed to what we were on before. Now, the next station along that track, to use a nice train analogy, of course, is Fulham the weekend, which is going to be a very interesting game because for me, even though I like what I've seen of Crystal Palace, and obviously they've taken points off Liverpool and away from home are very challenging because it was the first game of the season, which is always a little bit up in the air, I would look to this Fulham game as genuinely Arsenal's biggest challenge so far. The way that they started the season, the way in which Mitrovic has acclimatised the Premier League. I know he's played him before a lot, but yeah. I remember when he was with previously in the Premier League, it didn't necessarily click the same way after this amazing championship season he's had. They've also added a fair few very decent players, including a very well-known player to Arsenal in Bernd Leno. Mm. What do you make of the challenge of Fulham? And do you see it similar to me in that it's probably our biggest challenge so far, or are there areas that you think we're going to be able to exploit rather simply?
I know what you mean by biggest challenge so far, and I think on paper it's probably not.
Yeah,
but I think Palace has probably been the biggest challenge because they're a very good team, and I'd keep an eye on them for a top half finish actually this season. I think there's a lot of teams sort of in and around that 7th-8th bracket who are falling away, and I'd you know, just don't sleep on Palace. But Fulham, I think, have started well because they've got a style of play that's adapted quite well to the Premier League. So obviously Marco Silva wants to play nice football and wants to play out from the back and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, he's been pragmatic in the sense that they're going long a lot more. They're defending in numbers. They're doing things that you need to do. They're pressing quite high. And it'll be interesting to see how Arsenal cope with that because, as you mentioned, Mitrovic is a challenge to deal with aerially. Although I think in Saliba and Gabriel, Arsenal have two, you know, physical centre-backs who are capable of coping with that. And even Ben White tucking in at right-back is definitely capable of dealing with it. But, yeah, it's going to be a difficult one. It's not as nailed on the 3 points as I think the status of the two teams suggests. Interestingly enough, I saw a stat going around from Albino this morning that Arsenal have never lost at home to Fulham in any competition, which I don't know why I've said that out loud. It feels like I'm tempting fate.
This is like when I was looking at the weather forecast for my wedding day for the last 6 years. It's never rained, not rained once in the last 6 years. So you know what's going to happen.
It's going to be sunshine and smiles, and that's what I'm going to hear. That's what we want to hear, sunshine and nothing else. But I think Arsenal are going to, yeah, you've got to bat them to win this kind of game. And Fulham have shown they can cause problems. They cause Liverpool problems, although Liverpool started the season in a way that's not at their best, and Arsenal have started the season in a way that is at their best. And I think if Arsenal play as well as they've been playing in the past couple of games, I don't think Fulham will be able to handle that. I don't think it'll be a case of, like it was with Bournemouth, where Arsenal literally just have to sort of turn up and they'll win. Bournemouth were awful, particularly in the first half.
Yeah,
Fulham will be better than that. But at the same time,
is it not giving Arsenal enough credit when we say Bournemouth are awful? Because I feel like we made them awful. Do you know what I mean?
What you mean. I know what you mean. But obviously Arsenal were good and we've spoken a lot about that. But I think Bournemouth were awful in the sense they gave Arsenal a lot of space and they didn't go in for 50-50s and they dropped off and they sat very deep and they didn't really support their attack. They didn't offer much going forward, particularly after they went a goal down inside the first 5 minutes. And it was just like, well, I don't really know what you're trying to achieve here, Bournemouth, because, you know, the sitting behind the ball tactic isn't going to work when you're 1-0 down after 5 minutes. So you got to come up with something new. And they didn't throughout the whole game. I was really disappointed with them, actually, because I was quite surprised by their their start to the season when they beat Villa. But yeah, you know, let's make a fair point that they were poor because Arsenal were so good as well. It's sort of a 50-50. More maybe, let's go 70-30 in Arsenal's favour. But Bournemouth were poor. And they allowed Arsenal to be as good as they were in a way that I don't think Fulham will. I think Fulham will press a lot more, which means that Arsenal will maybe just, it's a different scenario to deal with. I don't know if they'll struggle, but the first three teams Arsenal have faced have been not the most intense. Palace were probably the most intense of the three. And I think Fulham will offer a different test. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how Arsenal deal with it because it'll be fun. Hopefully they win again. Hopefully it'll be 12 from 12.
Yeah, I mean, that if it is 12 from 12, you know, this it would be quite a significant length of time since Arsenal have won their first four Premier League games. And we think back
four
to...
Four or five, I think.
Is it?
Yeah. So,
yeah, it's quite an ask. What I would say is that, obviously, the fixtures are favouring us at the moment. You know, at the start of this season, we have been very fortunate with the way in which the fixtures have fallen. That said, you know, there was a lot of complaints about us playing Palace away from home on the first game of the season, you know, and
Friday night under the lights.
Exactly, yeah. So I suppose there's that, but we managed to overcome that challenge. At some point, Arsenal will lose points. Like we aren't going to win every single game.
And
do you think that's ultimately going to be the biggest test of this team? Not even maybe necessarily when we lose those points, but when we concede first in a game, that's going to be a true tell of character. Because I think there's only one game last season in the league where we went 1-0 down to Wolves and then came back to win it. It only happened once. So are you more confident in this side, if that happens, say, against Fulham, that Mitrovic gets kind of an early goal, that we can turn it around as opposed to where we struggled to do that last season? And then, of course, why do you think we could do it?
Yeah, I'd just like to distance myself from your negative Arsenal agenda right now. If you have any issues, he's at Tom Canton Media. Go for him there on Twitter.
Yes, the most negative Arsenal fan.
I am not saying Arsenal are not going to win every single game of the season. I will concede they may go behind at one point on the run to winning every game along the league. But yeah, how they come back from that will be interesting. And I think that links back to a lot of what we were saying earlier, isn't it, about Arsenal learning from their experiences last year and feeling that they can come back. And I think they're having a deeper squad makes a big difference. So if you look at the bench on Saturday, I know Arsenal didn't need their subs, but if you look at Emile Smith-Rowe, Eddie Nketiah, Fabio Vieira, Sambi Lokonga, Tierney, Tomiyasu, all players who, I wouldn't start. Fabio Vieira obviously wasn't here last season, but players who were sort of at points first team players last season and players who can make a difference in a game. Arsenal has suddenly gone from a position of having a ridiculously thin squad packed with, you know, under 21s players that I think some fans were sort of questioning, who are these guys? And now they know the names on the bench. And it's getting to a point now where we're having conversations about, you know, who do Arsenal leave off the bench, not who do they put on it. And
do you think he uses his bench well enough? Because I feel like he waits a long time.
I agree. And I think Saturday was a good example where it was obvious that Arsenal had won the game because Saliba scored early into the second half. And I'm thinking, I know you want Gabriel Jesus to get his goal, but take him off, give him a rest, let Eddie go, let Eddie run around, get a bit of confidence, give Emile Smith Rowe a run in the team, let's see what Fabio Vieira can do, those kind of things. But, you know, Mikel Arteta, I'm willing to concede he knows a bit more about football than me. So just this once. And I think, you know, he knows. But that's been a criticism of him from, I remember his first game, first couple of games at Arsenal, we were all thinking, oh, he loses, because we'd all got used to sort of the Arsene Wenger. And to be fair, we got used to the Unai Emery half-time subs, which were regular. But he tends to leave it quite late for the subs. But I think having five subs will change that, and maybe we'll see a few more earlier switches. But yeah, I think it is interesting to use them so late. I don't like it myself. I think if you're bringing on a sub, you want to give them a chance to impact the game, and bring them on in the 80th minute doesn't really do that.
Am I right in saying that Pep Guardiola didn't make a sub in the game against Newcastle the other day? I'm pretty sure.
I think now.
And if that is the case, and whilst I'm vamping and talking through, whilst I check for that, could it be that he's learned? I mean, I'm looking now, tell a lie, there was one sub made from the looks of things. Ruben Diaz came on really early on in the game.
He didn't make
any second half changes at all. In a game in which it was very open, and that, you know, they weren't looking great at times, and Newcastle took their 3-1 lead, which I know that the existing team obviously got back to 3-3. But even then, he didn't make any additions. Is this a Guardiola-ism that Arteta's kind of taken, this reluctance to use substitutions?
Maybe. I think maybe it's just like a case of him being really confident in plan A and wanting to give that its full chance to sort of go and sort of thinking, I trust my principles of play. I trust those 11 players I put out. I put them out to try and win this game for a reason. So I'm going to sort of try and trust them to see how far they can go. And I think that's big for Mikel Arteta. He doesn't seem like a guy who likes to admit when he's wrong that much, I think, as most football managers are. So Unai Emery, as much as we praised him early on for the sort of tactical tweaks and the half-time subs, a lot of the reason he was making those half-time subs is because he got it wrong in the first place. So I think with Mikel Arteta, maybe he makes the subs a little bit later because he trusts in his plan for the game and he trusts in his style of play and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's very Guardiola-y in the sense that Pep values his principles of play above all else. And obviously he wants to win, but he wants to win playing football his way. And I think that's pretty important for Arteta. That probably explains the whole late subs, even though I think there are certain circumstances, Bournemouth being one of those, where you can sort of tweak your principles to suit the situation.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's what I think will define our season is obviously the rotation. And this Fulham game is the first game in which we then face Aston Villa, another side, just a few days afterwards. Is it more likely that we see rotation in the Fulham game or the Villa game? Because, you know, Fulham, you would look at on paper as a team that you would think would be more beatable than Villa, but Villa haven't had the best of starts to the season either. And then, of course, there's the lingering kind of match of Manchester United on the Sunday, and having Villa in that midweek game, if you can rest a few players in that fixture to then be fully rested for Man United, that makes more sense. But is Villa the more tough fixture, so you therefore then use your more kind of capable players? So how do you kind of how
if
do you
ask me that? If you asked me that pre-Monday night, I probably would have said rest them all for the Man U game and then just sort of change play the sort of the reserve players.
Yeah,
because they'll probably win that anyway. But now it turns out Man U are not as bad as we thought, which is annoying. Although
Liverpool are just bad.
maybe Liverpool are bad. Maybe that should be a title of the podcast we put out. Just maybe Liverpool are bad, and see if people click on that. But I think it's an interesting one in terms of rotation. I'd be surprised if he makes too many changes for Fulham, just because why change a winning formula? there's no need to. And I think the guys who've been playing have been playing pretty well. There's no injury concerns as far as I'm aware. They've got a press conference on Friday where we'll find out a little bit more concrete about that. But I'd say, no, just stick with the team for Fulham and then make the tweaks against Aston Villa because, you know, four days later just makes more sense. And then obviously travelling to Old Trafford on the Sunday. So I think, yeah, Villa will probably be the game where I'd expect the rotation. I know on paper Villa are the better side, but Villa have had the poorest start to the season of the two.
True.
They've really disappointed me in sort of how they've played. And I'm not, you know, maybe we'll do a pre-Villa podcast. So I don't want to preempt that too much, but I think they're the kind of game, that's the game I'd expect Arsenal to get 3 points from, whereas Fulham I'm a little bit less certain. So yeah, I'd go full team against Fulham, switch up a bit on Wednesday night against Villa, maybe change your fullbacks around, maybe sort of give your Emile Smith-Rose a chance to, and then give yourself a decision to make ahead of United, because you can feel, those players will feel like, look, okay, going into this big game at Old Trafford, we've got a point to prove. And, you know, I think that could be the right way to go. Mikel Arteta didn't make that many changes, I noticed, in the second half of last season. And maybe that was because of the limited squad, but I think that did come back to bite Arsenal in the end. And yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, as you pointed out a second ago with the Bournemouth game, you know, if there is a chance to take off your star player and protect him, just do it. Like, just he doesn't have to get a goal. I know that he's the type of player, Jesus, that's hungry enough that if he doesn't get a goal, it's not going to affect his confidence. He's going to want to go into the next game and desperate to score in that one. So if we are 3-0 up in the 60th minute, get Nketiah on. Give him 30 minutes rather than 15. It is a frustration for me that we don't necessarily assess those situations. But like you said, you know, Arteta surely knows more about the game than we do. It's just frustrating when you think, see on the surface, and you're trying to think. Common sense surely dictates that that's the way forwards. But perhaps he sees it in a different way and sees that confidence is going to be key in trying to get those guys, especially Saka, I think, you know, we've not really talked that much about in this show.
No.
He really needs a goal. Like, really needs a goal. Because in the North London Derby, and I remember in the All or Nothing series, they focused quite heavily on the fact that he hadn't scored in something like, 17-odd games, I think.
Right.
And obviously he then scored in that North London Derby, and that was kind of the catalyst that then kicked him on. Do you think it's kind of the similar thing here? Whereas if he gets one, it would open the floodgates for the start of the season?
Maybe. I'm not that concerned about the Bukayo Saka starts the season. I think it's a case of Gabriel Jesus has very quickly become the centre of gravity in this Arsenal attack, and wherever he goes, the Arsenal attack just goes that way. So Jesus tends to drift to the left because he's right-footed and he's got that good relationship with Martinelli. Sort of Thierry Henry style, in the sense that he does drift out to the left and causes problems that way. And as a result, more of Arsenal's attack comes down the left. Actually, in the Bournemouth game, more of the attack did come down the right, and I thought that was, of the three, probably Saka's best game.
Yeah,
but he had a slow start to the season last season. We were all saying, is he having a Euros hangover? People are saying this year, is he having a hangover from last season where he played so many games? Saka's on penalties now, so he'll get goals. He'll get his chances to score. And I'm not worried about Bukayo Saka. He's an excellent player. And I think, you know, yeah, maybe he needs a goal to sort of just shake the external critics off his back. But I think internally, they're all very happy with how he's playing. And I think he himself will be fine with how he's getting along. I think he's doing well.
A couple of spontaneous features that I'm thinking of on the spot for the
podcast, okay.
Of which we may or may not keep depending on how well Kaya answers them. One is VAR watch, which I'm very curious to kind of, because, you know, VAR gets talked about a lot. But one of the big things over the weekend, and one of the big memes, I think, across social media, is the difference between the Rashford offside in the Manchester United game that was obviously given onside, and the Jesus offside that was given as offside in the Bournemouth game. How do we kind of tackle the realism of this and, you know, the consistency of this? Because, you know, I thought they were going to be giving these kind of the attackers a bit more leniency with these. Do you know what I mean? They're clearly not showing the lines anymore either. They've changed the system so that clearly you can't see where they're placing them until it flashes up on the screen. How much of a controversy and conspiracy am I buying into this one, Kyle?
I think this is the podcast that's going to finally break that FA conspiracy against the Arsenal team from the PGMOL. I think we're finally going to get to the bottom of that. And I think this is going to be the podcast that does it.
This is why you should subscribe.
This is why you need to subscribe, guys. We'll bring you more content as the weeks go on. But, if you're looking for consistency for from referees, you're going to be looking for a long time. It's like finding water in a desert. It's just not going to happen. I think, you know, there's always going to be these instances where the referees make decisions which dumbfound us all. If you look back, I mean, Chelsea, look at them with Mike Dean. Mike Dean coming out a couple of days later and saying, I wasn't sure in the moment that Romero was committing violent conduct against Cucurella. And then,
yeah,
I mean, you know, it doesn't take a second replay to realise he's yanked him down by his hair. But VAR makes weird decisions, and those lines are confusing. And I heard that too, in terms of them. I thought they were going to give more benefit of the doubt to the attackers, and it's not really what the offside rule is about, in the sense that the offside rule is designed to prevent people from goal hanging and designed to prevent people from sort of gaining an advantage on the defenders. And I don't really think Jesus had much of an advantage by being maybe a toenail ahead of the Bournemouth defender. Yeah. That's kind of my issue with VAR, is when you sort of challenge it down to the nth degree, there's going to be issues. But then there'll be times where referees make glaring errors, and, you know, we don't get those decisions. So yeah, it's important that Arsenal don't get too focused on that, because they did last season. I think it caused them a lot of issues, and Arsenal had a lot of refereeing decisions that went against them, and they didn't deal with it well. But this year, I think, hopefully they'll be able to deal with it better, and those things will hopefully even themselves out across the course of the season.
We'll have to see in next week's episode if we've got more VAR controversies regarding.
I have no doubt that there will be
discussed. And the second and final feature of the show is Kaya's FPL 5-star prediction. I know that Kaya is a dab hand at fantasy, not similar to me in terms of success rate. But if you were to pick an Arsenal player that you think players should be getting into their FPL teams for the game against Fulham, potentially even a captain's pick, who would you go for?
Gabriel Jesus. Not exactly controversial.
It's going to be a consistent theme now.
Yeah. Captain Gabriel Jesus against a team that's newly promoted from the Championship. It just makes sense. I think he's the kind of guy who will score goals, and goals win you the most points on fantasy football, if I'm not mistaken. You know, my FPL knowledge isn't great, but I'm pretty sure goals get you points. I had William Saliba in my team, and that did me pretty well over the weekend. As for Arsenal players, who else I've got? I've got Martinelli in there. But yeah, Jesus is the guy to go for, I think, as far as the FPL predictions go.
Yeah. The other is, I think, Granit Xhaka is a wild card at the moment.
Ah, yes.
Picking up assists, picking up a goal. You know, it's an interesting one. Indeed. So one to potentially keep an eye on. As this is, of course, the transfer window, which we won't have always the pleasure of discussing when the window is not open or leading up to the opening of the window, we should probably address, as we close things out, the latest rumours regarding Arsenal. Pedro Neto and Yuri Tielemans continue to be the two key targets. There is whispers of potential alternatives, the likes of Nikolai Mudrik from Shakhtar Donetsk. There's been suggestions of other potential alternatives as well. But how confident are you, Kaya, of either these or any others actually happening before the end of the window?
So for the Pedro Neto one, it depends, I think, on what goes on with Nicola Pepe. Obviously, we know that we reported on Football London that Nice are in talks, and it's not yet clear, as I said earlier in the podcast, whether an option to buy is included in that deal. I think that's sort of being suggested. Nicola Pepe is obviously in training with Arsenal right now, but that's being talked about and negotiated over as the deal continues to be ironed out. And that would open up a space in the squad for a forward. And I think Pedro Neto is the man that Arsenal have sort of honed in on to potentially be that man. They've got other targets as well, but I think Pedro Neto is the main one to go for. The difficulty is, and whether I'm confident about it, the thing that makes me less confident is Arsenal have spent quite a lot of money, and if they were to do a deal, it does seem as though they'd have to do it via instalments, and maybe the Jorge Mendes link could help with that, in the sense that he obviously helped Fabio Vieira deal get over the line earlier this window, and he's got a good relationship with Edu, and Edu's, you know, makes it a point of pride that he's got relationships with these agents, and I think he's very keen to try and take advantage of that as much as possible to help Arsenal. And if that helps him get Pedro Neto, fantastic, because he's a really good player. And I think he'd be a fantastic addition to the Arsenal attacking line. what else is there to mention? Tielemans is, of course, the big name that doesn't seem to go away. I saw a report yesterday that Leicester are asking for north of 50 million for him. That's not what I'd heard. I'm not saying that's wrong. I wouldn't put it past, you know, Leicester every right to go for that, but that's not what I've heard. I've heard it's a bit lower than that, what Leicester are asking for, and particularly at this stage of the window during the final week, where doesn't necessarily look that certain that Tielemans is going to sign that extension that was being spoken about. I think Arsenal may try Leicester's sort of mettle and see what they think in terms of maybe a late bid in the window, just to see whether Leicester are willing to accept that, because obviously he does have 1 year left in his contract and he does want to come to Arsenal. So yeah, that's something to keep an eye on. But as we keep talking about with the team, as we've discussed it every summer on the, you know, the Press Pass show on the Arsenal Way YouTube channel, it's just there's not much new to report in terms of movement. But I think this
does that
final
concern you?
No, because I think Arsenal are playing, and as you've reported as well, Arsenal are willing to wait, and they're playing a very clever game in the sense that they know they're in a strong position. They know Tielemans has 1 year left on his deal. So why would they move quickly to get the deal done? They're pretty stacked in midfield, as we've spoken about in previous other shows, sorry. And I think, you know, Arsenal are in a very strong position with the Tielemans deal. You know, if they get him, superb, because he's an excellent player and would be a fantastic addition to the squad. But if they don't, it's not the end of the world, I don't think. I think they'd be possibly more upset about missing out on Pedro Neto, because assuming Nicola Pepe does go, then you're looking beyond Saka on that right side. I know Arsenal want a player that plays across the front line in any of the positions at false nine, left or right. But beyond Saka, there is maybe a little bit of a drop-off. Obviously, Martinelli's played on the right and Smith-Rowe's coming on the left, and Jesus can play on the right. And there's options there, but in terms of out-and-out right-wingers, there's a little bit of a drop-off, and I think Pedro Neto would solve that. So I'd say that's the one they're probably more focused on right now, or more keen to get done. But yeah, we'll see what happens.
We'll have to wait and see. Indeed. Let me rephrase that just lastly. If we don't sign anyone and the window closes, should we be concerned?
I'd say no. I'd say that Arsenal will be fine with this squad. I think the squad's definitely good enough to take them through the first half of the season.
Yeah.
And, you know, Europa League and group games and Carabao Cup games and World Cup, obviously putting a pause on the season, means that there's not, you know, not a huge amount of games that there normally would be. I mean, obviously it's a bit more condensed, but I think Arsenal will be fine with the squad they've got. I think it's pretty strong in most areas of the pitch. And I think, you know, obviously a couple of areas where we'd all like to see them add a few players if they can, but I wouldn't say that Arsenal need it, which is different from previous windows where Arsenal have gone into the final day of the transfer window thinking, oh God, we need to sign someone. Now it's a case of, you know, fantastic. If we get someone, great. If we don't, we're happy with what we've got. And that's a really strong position to be in for negotiations as well. If they want to, they can walk away. And that's definitely positive for the Gunners.
Absolutely. I think that rounds things off quite nicely to a close. Thank you, everybody that's tuned in and listened to the pilot episode of the Arsenal Ways podcast. We're going to be endeavouring to bring you this show once a week with either myself, another host, and, of course, Kaya Karnat joining us every week. Kaya, thank you so much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it, as always.
That's my pleasure. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this first show. Do let us know what you think about it. I mean, let Tom know, at Tom Canton Media, me at Kaya Karnat 97, or just the Arsenal Way at Arsenal Way N5. Is that right?
Yep. That is indeed.
There we go. I've been listening. just let us know what you think, because we're this is a new podcast for us. We're sort of uncharted territory, and we're trying to work out what's best for you guys as an audience as well. So do let us know what you thought about this show, what you'd like to hear more of, what you think there's not enough of in the Arsenal podcast sphere. I mean, there's a lot of Arsenal podcasts, but I'm sure there's something that's not being covered that you guys would like to hear about more. So just let us know what you think, and we'll try and sort of serve your needs as an audience as much as possible, because that is what we're here for at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And you'll be able to find more of our content in written form, of course, over at football.london. Coverage of this weekend's game against Fulham will, of course, all be there, including team news, reaction, coverage throughout the game, and, of course, afterwards to any closure. So the transfer window will also be discussed, and hopefully we'll have some positive news to talk about in next week's podcast. As Kaya said, you can follow me on Twitter at Tom Canton Media. You can follow Kaya at Kaya Karnat 97. You can follow the Arsenal Way at the Arsenal Way. N5, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the show. If you are listening on any of the audio platforms, a review wouldn't go too far away either. So do drop us one on those platforms if you could. And in there, you can tell us what you've liked, what you've disliked, and of course, what we can do better to meet your podcasting needs. We will see you again very, very soon. And as always, please follow us on the Arsenal.